Hi, gang. It's Wendy. Welcome back to the Show Up or Shut Up podcast. This is season 4, episode 2. You probably can tell I'm off to a very, very slow start this year, 2024, with podcast episodes. There's just a lot going on behind the scenes with the production of a lot of different courses, which is pretty amazing. This year has really started off with a bang, and also a new collaboration with Art Foamies and Fodder School, which if you're in Fodder School, you know all about that. If you're in Fodder School 3, if you're not in Fodder School 3, you'll certainly be hearing all about that pretty soon. But there's just a lot going on. And on top of it all, we are hosting a wedding for our daughter and her fiance that's coming up in June. So it's been quite an eventful year in so many ways, and therefore not a year where I've been prioritizing the podcast. But occasionally I have something that I want to share with everyone, and today is one of those days. So in this episode, you are going to hear me interviewing my friend, my collaborator, former Fodder School teacher, extraordinary artist, wonderful human being, Karen Elaine Parsons. And you are going to hear all about her life story. And it's really epic. She's definitely someone you want to know all about. So I hope you'll really enjoy this interview with her. She has so much history with art, so much history in working in the arts, that it's really quite a joy just to peel back all the layers of Karen and get to know her better. It's taken me many years to feel like I'm still just kind of scratching the surface of Karen, but it is happening. It is definitely happening. Slowly and surely, I am getting to know Karen on deeper and deeper levels. So after this episode, you probably are not going to hear that much from me podcast-wise until after my daughter's wedding, when I am going to go into production on interviewing all of the brand new Fodder School 4 teachers. So we have not released yet the lineup of who those teachers are. We always have some returning teachers and always plenty of new teachers. And it looks like Fodder School 4 is shaping up to be our best year yet. So there's going to be a lot to talk about in those podcast interviews, and I am going to very much focus on producing them after my daughter's wedding in June. So you're going to get a lot more podcast episodes toward the second half of the year. Okay, so enough about the background of the podcast and what's coming and what's happening and all that stuff. I really hope you enjoy this episode with Karen Elaine. And I really hope that you check out her brand new course on Willow Workshops called Watercolor for Joy. Okay, enjoy the episode. Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up, a podcast about prolific makers, specifically in the world of mixed media art. I'm your host, Wendy Solganic, also known as Willow Wanders, and I'm here to explore the ups and sometimes the downs of being a prolific mixed media artist. I've been a maker my entire life, and I've had four, yes, four separate careers involving art. In each episode, we'll talk to artists about how they became prolific makers, why they make art, and the struggles they go through. We'll talk about being an online creative, social media, and how to navigate that world if that's what you're into. Whether you're a casual art lover of mixed media art and collage, or a serious artist making a living with art, whether you're a handmade book artist, an art journaler, a 3D assemblage creator, a fiber artist, a collage artist, or everything all at once, I hope you'll join me on this journey into the world of mixed media making. If you like this podcast, hit the subscribe button and leave a review. You can find me, Wendy, at willowwanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders and at fodder.school. Today we're welcoming Karen Aline Parsons to the Show Up or Shut Up podcast. And I'm truly excited to record this podcast episode and to have an opportunity to really go in depth into Karen's life and career in the arts. With that being said, welcome to the podcast, Karen Aline. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Wendy, for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation.
All right. The reason that we're recording now and that I'm bringing this to the audience now is because Karen is about to release a big course on watercolor in collaboration with the Willa Workshops. Given that, let's just start at the beginning, Karen, because I have so many questions. Karen, where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles County in California, right? It's called El Monte. People wonder where that is, but it's east of LA a little bit. And I was born there and moved to Anaheim when I was a young girl with my parents. My dad liked to change houses every 2 years. I don't know why, but we never really grew a lot of roots. We kind of moved around and we weren't military. So I have no idea why he chose to do that. But we lived all over Southern California until I moved to San Diego when I was in junior high school.
So is it that your dad loved architecture and homes and wanted to experience different homes? Or is it that he was riding the financial wave of California and was like, you can just keep trading up, you can make more money? Because basically that's what happens in California. You buy a house and you just watch your net worth increase.
Exactly. I think that's part of maybe both. My dad was a talented cabinet maker. And he liked to remake a house really beautiful. He'd put slate floors in and make it much more gorgeous than when we started. And just as we're getting used to it and really loving it, we'd move. So that's why it's so hard for me to move now. I don't want to move.
Okay, but that makes total sense. Because if your dad was a rehabber, then yeah, it was like an investment. He was buying a property. He was fixing it up. You guys were living in it and then he would flip it and you guys would move. So that makes total sense financially.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it kind of helped me socially because I was able to adapt pretty quickly to new situations, especially schools. So I think it was good for me as a kid, for sure.
When did you realize that you liked arts and crafts?
Oh, it's in my DNA. My grandfather was an artist and I never met him, but I inherited his art supplies. My mother loved her dad and it was just well known. He was he was a commercial artist and he was also a watercolor painter. When he wasn't doing his regular job as a designer, he did, they call it, oh boy, my brain just had a moment there. He was a sign painter. He also did window dressing in the 50s and 40s. That's where an artist would come in and do everything from scratch. And he would do beautiful windows for major department stores. And then he also worked for the government and did buy bonds posters. And he lived in Nebraska near Omaha. And he was quite a figure in our lives. And I never even met him.
Wow. So when you say that you inherited his art supplies, can you sort of bring me a visual of what that was like?
Yes. As a young girl, I kind of recalled just seeing these beautiful rolls, like little leather rolls with Prismacolor pencils and watercolor palettes, a ceramic or porcelain, actually. It had the crackling in it. It was just really beautiful. His paintings, I had a big stack of his watercolors. He had full-size sheets, 22 by 30 inch watercolors that he would take out and do some plein air painting. And those things were with me for most of my young life. And I was also, as a little girl, finding any empty page that I could, or empty surface, I would be drawing on it or scratching on it. So my parents were like, oh my gosh, give her some crayons or something, because she's destroying the books in the house, even really nice books that were in the house. Any place there was a blank area, I was sketching in it. So it was kind of started. It's just what I wanted to do. And as a
Did you
child, I just
take?
wanted to be an artist. I didn't want to do anything else. I just wanted to do what my grandfather did.
Wow, did you take art classes in high school? Were you one of the kids who was in the fine art
Oh, yeah.
kind of track in your high school?
Absolutely. I had a wonderful art teacher in high school. His name was Keith Stevens in San Diego, and he noticed me and a couple other students, and he just kind of brought us along into college level art classes. We would do figure drawing. In fact, the first time I saw a naked man was a figure drawing class in high school. And I was expecting a female figure, and this little hairy legs come out, and I thought, uh-oh, what am I doing? But it was really a wonderful experience to be able to do life drawing and really see the figure, not as a person, but as shapes and lines, and just getting into that practice. And I did that every Friday night for years after he introduced me to that.
And did I hear you mention something about how maybe that led you to applying to officially art school?
Yes, I actually was very, I wanted to do the traditional art school, gallery, museum kind of life. I was really interested in all the artists like Paul Klee and all the, just the one that you just saw, Frida Kahlo. And I just was really interested in that life. And I started to just take figure drawing. And then in after high school, I started to take classes now. I'm terrible. I was taking all the classes that I wanted to take in college, but I was having a difficult time with the other classes. But I built up quite a lot of credits, but I just kind of kept going in the art. I just wanted to keep doing that. And I moved, actually, I got married and left San Diego and moved to Santa Barbara, and I started to go to a city college there to take courses. And I met with this wonderful man, Robert Frame. He was an artist, but also a teacher at the college, and he mentored me. It was amazing. His paintings were incredible, very expressive, and I was working in large scale paintings. I was doing portraits. It was kind of this track that I was on, and I started to join art associations and started to submit work in galleries. And I was way too immature. My work was immature. You know, it was certainly not developed yet, but I was doing it. I was showing on the beach at Santa Barbara. People would sell their art on the beach every Sunday. And what a beautiful place to do it, right? And it was really wonderful. And then, but there were some things about it that didn't sit well with me. You take some of your work to a museum or gallery, not really a museum yet, wasn't ready for that. But I'd take my work and I'd get juried, and I always had a funny thing about judging art. But I did it for a while, and then I kind of backed away from it just because of the experiences, some of the experiences that weren't resonating with me. And I got involved in teaching special education, doing an art studio with people with developmental disabilities. And that was really fulfilling, absolutely fulfilling. And their work inspired me to kind of develop working in abstract more than just doing representational. And I just kept trying to explore my creativity. Where am I fitting in this world? Because I really wasn't comfortable in the museum world or the gallery situations. I just felt I liked teaching, just kind of exploring, kind of figuring out what is it that I want to do. I knew that I wanted to always create. That's what my happy zone was. And it was my peace zone. It's where I really felt at one with the world. Even if the world was going crazy, I could still feel okay. And I could process and I could tell my story without really saying it in words. And then people could interpret that story however they want. But I just started to do that work in, as I was developing my own work, I was sharing and kind of guiding these wonderfully gifted people who had a connection with their creativity that didn't have a filter, those students. They were so wonderful. And I just kept exploring my creativity that way.
Okay, so I want to back it up a little bit because I am truly interested in every aspect of your story. Because as people are going to find out, you've had an incredibly wide variety of art experience. So you graduate from high school. You're living, it sounded like, in San Diego.
Yes.
And then did you apply to college or art school at that time?
When I was, let's see, but I'm trying to back, this has been a quite a few years, but I met my first husband around the time that I was going to places like San Diego State. And my family was not a college. My dad was a cabinet maker. My mother was an opera singer. I come from a family of creatives, but they were just sort of grassroots. They weren't highly educated. My cousin, I had family members that were. And so college wasn't really pushed like in some families.
Gotcha. Okay. So I think I'm using the wrong terminology because I'm thinking you applied to some type of formal art school after high school. That was what I was kind of getting at was, did
Right.
you go to these programs where it's geared toward everybody's going to be a gallery artist and they're pushing a certain narrative about what art is and how to be a proper artist? Did you go after high school to that kind of experience or school, or did you skip over that?
I intended to go. I wanted to go. I was dreaming about it. The art, like the Pasadena Art Center College of Design. I was really wanting to do that. Kind of had a detour though. I met my first husband, and within 3 months we were married and we moved to Santa Barbara. That was not in my plan, but I'm really happy that I did that. Santa Barbara had a wonderful city college system, and also UCSB had a great art department too. So I was thinking I wanted to do that, but then another detour. I had a couple of kids.
Okay, so you were very young. All right, so this is painting a more full picture to me. So shortly after high school graduation, you met your first husband. And then you detoured from San Diego to Santa Barbara, where there's a very rich, full art culture, art opportunities, lots of very affordable California state supported art education. For example, when I lived in Los Angeles, I got the bulk of my art education in life from Santa Monica College,
I know that
SMC.
one.
And it was $13 a credit. So I was paying $39 to take the full semester of drawing one, the full semester of drawing two, the full semester of design. I was paying $39.
Amazing, huh?
It was a miracle. Okay, so you get to Santa Barbara with your husband, but you're pursuing art and at the same time starting a family.
Yes.
Okay, now kind of pick up where it goes.
So I'm handling the babies and being a housewife, and at the same time, still I have time to develop my art. And my husband was very supportive of it. We actually had a bought a home where he helped me build a beautiful studio, in which, me in my early 20s, not even old enough to drink yet, and I have this beautiful studio, and he supported everything I wanted to do. And so I was really a full-time artist and mom at the same time. And I always used to say, if the kids are still alive at five, I've done my job. I mean, I was always trying to juggle the parenting, and also I had that desire to create art and to develop my art. So it was nice to have support, and he was wonderful that way. And I was just painting and trying to explore, and that's when I was doing, I we're kind of getting up to that place where I was displaying my work at the Sunday Beach show. I don't have photos of it, but it wasn't nearly ready for prime time, but I did it anyway. It was kind of going through the steps of being an exhibiting artist, and then joining the art associations and getting involved in juried shows and things like that. That's when that happened. And my kids were really young, and I was doing the mom thing, doing wife and artist at the same time.
So, I'm going to interrupt. That is so hard. Like, when I had young kids, I did not have energy at the end of the day to walk into an art studio and start painting and then figuring out how I was going to get care for my little kids while I exhibited at a local art walk. Like, how did you manage? Was your husband super hands-on with your kids?
Yes, and I remember I had a good support system, a mother, and very good support system, and I was able to do those things. And I had a lot more freedom than other people in my situation. Absolutely. I had a lot more leeway to explore my creativity. And I think because They knew that's what I really wanted to do. I was being a mom and I was kind of young. I didn't wait. And it wasn't an accident. These were planned pregnancies and I was happy and fulfilled. And I just felt that yeah, I could do it. I felt like I had the energy to do it. And I did the best I could with what I had.
Was your first husband, was he significantly older than you?
Just a few years, not significantly, but a few years, about 5 years. And that's a big difference maturity-wise. I wasn't really mature as far as a developing woman. I was a little young. I just turned 20 when I got married. That is young. And things happen very fast. That's the kind of the way I roll, though. I kind of think, let's go for it. Jump in feet first. And it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I'm really happy I moved to Santa Barbara because I think it was a great place to develop art and just to have a family in those days. Now it's really expensive to be there and it's changed, but it was such a wonderful little hippie town when I first moved there.
So when you were showing at the art walk, because I feel like in California, that's what, like, was it an art walk?
It was this gorgeous, right on the beach, the long strip where they have a nice, big, huge sidewalk that meanders through the palm trees and the grass. And it's a fabulous place. And you had the art side. So this is funny because I got the craft and the art start to merge because I was on the painter's side. So there's a whole section at that time where it was artists and painters, watercolorists, big scale paintings, either framed or unframed, typical things to go on the wall. And then the other section down on the other side, there was a whole section of ceramic artists, jewelry makers, crafty kind of things. And I would walk the show sometimes. And I was really attracted to some of that. So I started to make these little jewelry, small pieces of jewelry that looked like my paintings, like little mini paintings. And they were made out of shrink plastic. Do you remember Shrinky Dinks?
Oh, yeah.
I have to thank my kids for that because when I gave the kids a set or someone gave my kids a set of Shrinky Dinks, of course, I'm doing what I did when I was little, any blank surface, right? I'd have to draw on or play with. So I took the little blank pieces out, cut out the cartoons, give them to the kids, and then I'd play with it. And I was fascinated because I was able to do some artwork and then it would shrink into this magical little thing. And I made these little necklaces, earrings, just jewelry pieces out of that. And then I decided to move from the painter side to the craft side because the craft side, they were making the money. People were selling things. It was active because people could take them away. It wasn't something you had to put on your wall. And I found that really exciting.
Did anyone buy your paintings during this time?
My family, maybe, mostly. No, just kidding. No, a couple. I had a couple sales, but it was pretty quiet always. And it was that way with most of the artists on that strip. Some would learn that marketing their paintings more for a tourist was pictures of Santa Barbara, the boardwalk, or certain areas that the tourists would pick up something like that to take home, and it would be a small, something small they could take in their suitcase. That I didn't do that. I had these huge things. The wind would blow them off into the street. It was just kind of crazy. But when I did the little pieces, it changed everything. I was like, whoa, people like my art. And they took it with them. And I did very well. I sold lots of my pieces that people were asking me to do series. And then some people wanted the larger artwork as a result of the little pieces. So it was kind of a, those little pieces were sort of a way, a gateway to the bigger ones. And it was really fun. It was really a fun time to do that.
That's some really valuable information about selling art right there that you shared. Like, 'cause there's definitely a lot of people who are thinking always, right? We're always thinking, I love making stuff, but what am I going to do with this stuff?
Exactly.
And many of us have thought or even tried to sell art at fairs. And knowing that having a lot of small pieces that people can buy could lead to stronger overall sales. And then occasionally you might get someone who buys a big piece as a result of falling in love with you.
That's exactly it. I remember an experience where I was doing a show. It was like a group show. A bunch of different artists were showing at this place right near that space on the beach. It was a big building, really gorgeous building. I don't remember the name of it now, like the Veterans Building or something. And I had probably about six pieces in there. And during that, this is like over a period of years, but I was already separated from my husband at the time, just kind of newly separated. And there was a piece he saw my work and he goes, "Well, what else do you have?" And I said, "Well, you can look at my portfolio." So he opened it up and he goes, "I want that." And he was a collector. And he goes, "I want that." And it was a painting that was still in my old house. I'm like, okay, well, we'll have to make an arrangement. But it was wonderful. It was a huge piece. And he put it in over his mantle in his home in Santa Barbara. And he had a gorgeous home. And I felt, wow, that piece was in my old bathroom. It was a large piece, but it was in my bathroom covering a whole wall, basically because I had nowhere else to put it. And this man looked at it in a totally different light. He loved it and he wanted it in his focal point of his house. I was blown away. And then I realized, I thought, I don't know, I can't really judge my work. I don't know what is good and what isn't. And that was still in the earlier, I think I had been painting for a little under 10 years at that time when I was still exploring again, exploring styles, exploring my color choices, exploring. I was basically kind of being inspired by other artists, really, and I hadn't really found my niche yet. And that took 40 years or 50 years to find that. But, and I'm still trying to find it.
Do you still have any of the pieces that were created around the time that you were a new mom in Santa Barbara showing your work at the art walk?
Some of my family have it. My mom used to have a lot of it, and she passed away, but some of the family that is still here, there are probably a few pieces here and there, and many pieces that I still had, I covered them up. And I don't know what happened to the collector, what he did with it, but there are pieces that were in different public spaces. I had some work in public places. I don't know what happened to them. I don't keep track. Basically, when a piece leaves my hands, I don't keep track of it. But I think that there might be some, goodwill for all I know. I just don't know. But those pieces are so different from the work I do now. It's like night and day. It isn't me at all. It's
So
amazing.
what would you say the big differences are that you notice from where you started to, let's say, where you are now? Even though I don't want to skip over any of your gigantic story, it's just I am curious about when you say my work is so different, what do you mean by that?
So in Santa Barbara, as I was exploring watercolor, I was exploring acrylics, oil, every medium, traditional art medium that I could, started working. I really didn't find myself attracted to oil painting at all. I mean, I did it, but I didn't really enjoy the process. I just was more attracted to the instant watercolor and acrylics for sure. And what really changed significantly, and of course, we can talk, of course, the story is. There's a reason why it changed, but my color palette was very subdued and very muted. And my subject matter at the time was very turbulent, if that's the right word. I was going through a lot of emotional and mental challenges. Being a young woman, I had some things going on, let's just say. And I was using the art as a way to process. And so it really shows. It kind of shows that I was struggling as a person. And so it was very dark, if that makes sense. It was kind of dark. And a lot of self-portraits had this side that was compassionate and a side that was very critical. And I would show those in my artwork and the struggles. So Picasso had his blue period. I had that time. It was about 10 to 12 years as I was getting more skilled in communicating through art, it was really showing this struggle. And a lot of collectors, they might enjoy it in a gallery. They might say, oh, these are really nice pieces, or they're bringing a lot of emotion, or they're whatever. But to have it in their home, not so much because they're emotional, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would love to see them. They sound pretty amazing, even though it's different and obviously not what you do now. It does sound like they might have been pretty amazing. And again, maybe not for collectors, maybe not something that people want to look at every day on their wall of their home, but for you personally, it does sound like that was a pretty awesome way of you exploring your emotions.
Yes, I do have photographs somewhere. I have some slides, and I should probably look for those and maybe just show them because it is part of my history. It's part of who I am and part of the way I dealt with life and the challenges that I was facing as a human. And now that it's way past, it's many years ago, decades ago, it's something I can look back at and feel like growth, feel I could see a total change in myself over the years, big time.
That's pretty amazing to have even the photographs of it to have as your own remembrance, like a very visceral remembrance of your own process and growth.
Yes, I do have a box underneath my bed. It's this big box of paintings, figure drawings that are of that time. They're not the framed ones, they're not the big canvas pieces, but my daughter's name is on it. My youngest daughter wants to be the caretaker of all that, and I'm happy that someone wants it. So it's sitting under my bed.
Wow. Okay. All right. So let's go back to the point where you're showing in Santa Barbara. You've transitioned to the other side of the street where the crafts are. Suddenly you're selling, is it sounds like jewelry or was it small art pieces?
Some kind, it was jewelry, but it was wearable art. That's what I called it.
Okay. So what happens then?
So I'm doing that and I'm enjoying it. Then I started to get, it was really hard for me when I would produce some things, and if I had to do a number of them, I would not be motivated. I really enjoyed creating, but I didn't enjoy production. Doing something over and over. Someone would say, I want 20 or 30 or 40 of these. And I would just cringe. I just felt like my creativity was crushed if I had to create a bunch of them. So I looked into hiring some people to produce for me. And I actually did get someone to do that. And that was sort of kind of a dead end because I didn't really enjoy producing a large series. And we're not talking just a couple of, it was a store wanted to sell these as part of their line, and it just wasn't for me. And at
So
that, around that,
that, I'm going to
yeah,
interrupt you again. That's
sure.
part of the grind of being an artist that sells their work,
Yes.
which is probably why most of us can't really hack being an artist that sells our work.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to sell and actually be able to support yourself selling art, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to keep creating things until you find what people love. And then when you find what people love, you're going to have to create it over and over and over again. And if your desire to create is really based on the joy of trying out new things, it's really difficult to be an artist who sells their work in a way that could support themselves.
So true. So true. You hit that right on the head. It became a grind. I didn't want to wake up and do it. It was just not for me. And at that time, I was sort of transitioning. Well, because I did separate from my husband, I needed to make a living to support myself through my own contributions. So started working in a school for developmentally disabled adults. And it was a fabulous place that I was able to get a job and to develop my own style of teaching. I started to teach, or guiding more than teaching, but it was just a fabulous experience working from starting out there as a just helping in the kitchen and then helping with Special Olympics and then getting involved in developing an art studio program. And then eventually these artists all became exhibiting artists. In fact, the location still is in Santa Barbara. They also have a gallery there now, and they show all the time. And I was there in the beginning, and it was fantastic. And so I was doing that, and I really stopped producing craft just to make money. I did it for fun. I started to do it again for fun, which is why I do it. I started making earrings and little pieces of mini art and painting again just for joy while I had the job at the school.
It all makes sense to me. Just the whole being drawn toward teaching and facilitating and administering as a way of supporting yourself and not having the art itself be what supports you. Because I too have to make money. That's the reality. I don't have a trust fund.
Exactly.
That's why I think a lot of people are drawn to teaching because. Just because of exactly what we just talked about, art can become a terrible grind if you're trying to sell art to support yourself. So it
Yes.
sounds like what you got involved in was incredible.
It
Absolutely
wasn't, yes,
incredible.
it was incredible, and it was at the same time, I have a sensitive soul, so I felt really compassionate, and I got very emotionally involved with all of the clients at the time. And after about 5 years, it was very taxing on me emotionally. So I had about 5 or 6 years into it, I started to look for other ways of making a living. I decided I was going to work at an art supply store. What better place to work than an art supply store for somebody who needs to supply her art supply habit?
And
So,
just likes to be around it, right? This is actually another good tip. It's if you really love art, but you don't want to sell the art, work in an art supply store.
exactly. And I'm still in my 20s. I'm not even 30 yet. And I'm loving this. The art supply store was an amazing place for me to learn about every art material I could ever learn. And I would do light fast tests, and I was installing how-to things. I mean, I was having fun. I was able to be creative in that place because not only am I selling art supplies, I'm actually creating these little programs on how to do things with those art supplies. And the corporate loved that. They sent me all over California to install these little how-to kiosks that I developed for the one store. And it was really a fun and creative experience. And that kind of led to my relationship with Yasutomo because I was working in the art supply store. I would meet all the reps that would come in that were selling the vendors, the different manufacturers that would come in. And I was fascinated with the job that they had because they were traveling, they were going from store to store, they weren't stuck in one place, and they were in art supplies. And I thought, ooh, this is an interesting thing. Yeah. So that kind of over a period of maybe about 8 years of being in the art supply industry as a retailer and really working in all the aspects of retail, doing merchandising and purchasing and the whole, all of that. I got into management, just everything,
This is
starting from.
all for a chain of art stores.
Yes.
What was the name of the chain?
It is now Blick Art Materials, but it used to be the art store, which
The art
was,
store. Yes, I know
and
that.
actually,
Oh my God.
yeah, it was the art store. It was a little Standard Brands paint store, if you remember that. Standard Brands back in the old days, they developed a little small art section, and then it became an independent art store over the years. And then the chain developed into the art store, and then eventually it was purchased by Blick, and it's still running, of course.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this basically spans your 30s. You're working at the art store and you're meeting all the reps and you are developing ways of marketing products.
Yes.
That is so cool.
It was an adventure because I really love the art supplies, and actually I like the idea that I had this plethora of and choice of art supplies, and I could really explore each one and why are they here in the store? Why am I selling this art supply? And I was fascinated with it, and I ended up having an opportunity when the art store sold to, well, it was actually Standard Brands sold to the art store, and I had to relocate my work. Even though I still lived in Santa Barbara, I had to relocate my work to Pasadena, which is a good 2 hours away. And that was a stress on my life. I mean, I did it for a period of almost a year, just commuting back and forth, staying at friends' house in LA. I was helping to establish the store in Pasadena that's still there on Green, I think it's Green Street. And even though I think it's a Blick, but it was really hard on my life to do that. So I moved out of that and I got the job with Yasutomo.
Okay, just as a just point of note here, for people who are not in fodder school, which I'm sure there's still plenty of people who listen to this podcast that are not in fodder school. So if you're not in fodder school, then here's something about Karen that you won't know. Karen's wealth of knowledge about art supplies is enormous. And I never understood Karen because we haven't talked about your whole full story. I never understood why you had such a wealth of knowledge. But you are always surprising me and always amazing me with the things that you bring into fodder school. So it's like whatever the project is, Karen has bonus content for those lessons because you always expand our knowledge on everything we do. And now I understand why.
Yeah.
That's
Well,
amazing.
if I were an addict or something, I'd be around, I'd be in a drugstore. But this was like, okay, I'm an art supply addict. I love art supplies, if they're good, especially. And I just think I was in heaven, right? I could ex try different supplies. I was really inquisitive about everything about like color pigments and light fastness and all of the properties that really give the person who's using it that feeling of joy with the colors and whatever they're using, the mark making tools, the whatever it is that gives a creative person joy. I was obsessed with paper. I'd go through the paper drawers and I would be like, okay, these are made in India, these are made in Japan, and these are made in England. It was just fascinating. So it kept my mind, my kind of monkey mind, really busy, just absorbing all I could. And I don't know why. I wasn't trying to be an encyclopedia of art supplies, but I was really just absorbing everything I could. And it kind of kept my mind very focused. And I just kind of built this kind of library in my head of knowledge on art supplies. And yeah, it pops out sometimes in the fodder school because I go, oh, yeah, that's right. I could do this with that.
It works really well. Okay. So, how do you end up going from working for the art store to saying, okay, I'm going to go work for a manufacturer?
So, well, first of all, retail, if you know what retail is and you're in management, you probably don't get a day off, right? It's 10-hour, 12-hour days, especially if you have employees that don't show up. You're going to open and close the store. Now, I was looking forward to a 5-day week, which is what the manufacturer's reps were telling me. I was like, oh, 5 days a week? I can have a weekend off? Wow, that would be incredible. And that's the association with Yasutomo happened because there's a really cute story. The rep that she was the Los Angeles area rep. She would come into the Pasadena store that I was working at, and she had this origami book. And I was like, ooh, I loved origami. Has been part of my history since I was making gum wrapper chains as a teenager. It's another little activity that kept me at peace and kept my hands busy. And I just was fascinated with it. And this woman brought in this book, and I know she went to the local Kinko's and copied a couple of pages because I was fascinated with these models. She was an origami enthusiast. And we just started talking and we hit it off. And she's the one that told me that Yasutomo had an opening for a sales rep. And do you want to try? And I said, absolutely. So she's the one that connected me with Yasutomo. And they were based out of San Francisco at the time. And they flew me up there and interviewed me a couple of times. I think I was part of maybe four candidates. The difference that I think that I brought to the table, rather than the others, were salespeople. They had field sales experience. They were seasoned sales reps, but I had the retail experience. I knew the competitors' products. That was a little different take on it. And also, I was an origami. I think I wooed them with the origami because I kept folding while I was interviewing. They thought, whoa, she can fold paper.
That is so funny. Okay, so then what happened?
So I got the job and I was so excited. Like, oh my God, I'm growing up. I'm growing up. I get to work for this wonderful company and a full-time employee with a company car, the whole thing. And it was fantastic. They were based out of San Francisco. I lived in Santa Barbara and I would commute to San Francisco once a month to just have some office time with them. And I had a territory from north of Santa Barbara down to south of LA. And at that time, there were a lot of retail stores, lots of them, and Japanese stores, import stores. And I would cover that area. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I was sent to a show in Vegas. It was called HIA, the Hobby Industry Association. And I got to try out just being at a trade show for the first time. And I started to demo in the booth. It wasn't a planned thing, but they noticed that I could demo the supplies and talk at the same time. It looked like I was multitasking. So they were very happy that I could do that. And I started to go to the trade shows, and they kind of transitioned me over a period of time from the sales rep position to where I'm at now, the creative position, developing products, teaching, showing, education, basically doing what I do now, actually, still after th almost 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years.
Yeah.
That's an incredible corporate success story, is starting with a company 30 years ago and still being with them. So, just out of curiosity, you said that when you started working for them, they were located in San Francisco.
Yes, it was owned by a man, my former boss, Dan Igusa, and it was a family business, basically. His aunt and uncle were the founders, and he came into the business with a degree in business, I believe, accounting. He ran the company after the owners passed away, and he didn't really expect that he was going to do this, but he ended up making it his lifelong career as well. And he and I still have a friendship and respect for each other. He sold the company in 2019, just before the pandemic, whew, lucky, to a company that is based in Torrance. The company is called American Kusa Corporation. It has roots in Japan, and it was the perfect fit. It couldn't have been a better fit and a better place or a better group of people to take over the Yasutomo brand, because Yasutomo was kind of up in the air what was going to happen with Yasutomo as a brand, and with the history that was so rich and so many wonderful stories about that. That's another podcast. But when Kusa purchased, I remained as a consultant. I was very afraid of being a consultant and being self-employed, but it is the best thing I've ever done. They've taken the brand, they've continued the vision that the first owners had, and they still have Dan as the consultant as well. So he's still part of it, and I'm a part of that as long as I want to be, it seems anyway.
Let's just kind of paint a picture of what Yasutomo is, like what it was when you started there, and then what it is now, as it is now in its like phase two or second life or whatever after it got bought. So, was Yasutomo primarily Japanese products that were imported to the United States and sold in art stores? So, things like Sumi ink, origami papers. Do you call them Japanese brushes? What are the brushes, the Asian brushes called?
Well, we had a kind of a mix of Japanese and different levels of price points. So the Japanese brushes were more expensive, and then the brushes made in China were less expensive. And the thing that Yasutomo did in the beginning was, of course, importing Japanese supplies, gifts, stationery, and art supplies, and then exporting snack goods to Japan. It was kind of an import-export business back in the early
Really,
80s.
they would take American snack goods and import them in the other direction?
Exactly, like Planters peanuts and just some basic American snacks, that Yasutomo was an importer for those goods. And that was still happening even before they sold it. Now, they're not doing that now. They're not exporting snack goods anymore.
Gotcha.
Dan
That
kept
is
that part.
really fascinating.
Isn't it? Yeah. So it was funny because at the end of that period, I was actually helping the snack website, the export part. So I kind of used to enjoy sampling the snacks, trying them out. But that was a really smart move on the owner's parts to have an import export business, because as the yen would go up and down or the dollar would change, you would have balance. And that's
Yeah.
how Yasutomo could stay in business for so many years. I mean, this is 70 years this company has been in business, 70 years this year. And I'm almost at that age myself. It was a good formula. And now with Kusa, with their support and the support of the brand, it's been amazing. And I'm just seeing wonderful things happening. And I'm get to go along on this journey with them and help. They had basically no experience in the art supplies. Their experience is writing instruments and office supplies, and they're really good at it. And they're very successful. So the art supplies were kind of new to them. And so I'm really happy that I can be that person, not only bring my years of experience and knowledge to their brand, but also kind of having the information for competitors. And when I say competitors, I don't mean it in a negative way. It's actually friendly. I mean, it's a really friendly industry. You probably know, you had that experience. You got to meet the people there. Everybody's very friendly, and even though it's a competitive industry, there's a lot of friendly competitive. I don't even know what to call that.
When did you begin getting involved in product design and research and development on what products would be expanded to and brought to market? Was that only after Yasutomo sold to KUSA, or was this happening before?
It was happening way before. In fact, I have a little story about the water brush.
Everyone knows the water brush. I hope so.
The Niji water brush. Now, that was my first little foray into development. I was in Japan in the Ginza district, and I was in this beautiful little store that had art supplies in there. And I saw this little brush that had sumi ink in it. And then I saw little empty ones because they were intended to put sumi ink for the calligraphers and the sumi artists to work with. And I picked up a sample and I talked to my boss. I said, "Wouldn't this be great if we could use this for watercolor?" And he said, "Oh," he didn't really understand what I was talking about. He thought, "Well, I don't understand how that could be anything." And I remember going to all my customers when I was still a rep. So this is over 20 years ago. And I kind of asked everyone that I would see it. What do you think of this? What do you think of this as just to hold water in so you could put water in the barrel, not ink, but water, and use it for watercolor? And I had to do a petition basically because that was just the first time to introduce something that was a little unusual. And so with that, they did decide to bring it in, and it was a very successful, still is. And that was my first experience in kind of developing a product. Even though it existed already in Japan, it was a new market here in the United
It was a
States.
new use for a product that existed, which is in a, it's an invention in and of itself that you saw something and then thought there's a different use for this.
Yes. So that, and over the years, when Yasutomo was still in San Francisco, I think to save money, because we had design houses doing products, and they found that I was very interested in developing products. So I started to do the kind of product development with another woman. We were working together. So she was the sales, she had more sales history and marketing experience than I did. So she and I, as a team, would work on ideas. So I would come up with an idea, and if she liked it, if we both liked it, if we both kind of agreed that this would be something that would work, we would start to develop it. And that went on for years. We did that, and it was on a budget because we were just doing it ourselves. So between she and I would come up with, say, a concept, and then she would roll it around in a marketing way, and then I would develop it artistically, and then she would do sales. It was really a wonderful partnership, kind of volatile at times because I would want something so badly, and then she would say, "No, I don't think this is going to work." And I'd be, "Oh, no, but I want this." But it was good because if it was just me, it would have been a disaster.
So Yasutomo has a full catalog of different art supplies. People may not know the name Yasutomo exactly, but now they will. They may not realize how many different supplies Yasutomo has manufactured and distributed. Just so many watercolor sets and all different types of brushes and colored pencils, watercolor pencils. Crayons, pigment stick type crayons, palettes, just the list is very long. So, would you say that being there for 30 years, you've been involved in a lot of the catalog?
Oh, definitely. Because at this time, I am the only artist in residence. I think I have my hand in most of the stuff that's in that catalog, except for the writing instruments. I'm not really that interested in writing instruments. That's a whole thing on themselves. I mean, some people that are passionate about writing instruments, they really get into the mechanics of pens and pencils and mechanical pencils. That is not my area. But any of the art supplies, the traditional Japanese art supplies that come in, even though I'm not really a practiced sumi artist, but I've dabbled. I've been able to get enough information that I could sort of help develop those products that are coming in. I developed the fusion brushes that are,
Let's talk about that because
yeah,
that's
no, you love
hands
those.
down, that's my favorite Yasutomo product and I use it almost every day. So tell me about the history of the fusion brushes. And I mean, I can tell you how I feel about them, but let's talk about it. So go for it.
Okay, so the fusion brush. I have samples from many years of being at Yasutomo. I have these samples, this brush that had a nylon tip and it had a plastic handle, but it looked very much like an Asian brush, except it performed like a Western brush. So I had these samples in my possession. And when I talked to, I think it was, well, I know I talked to Phoebe. So Phoebe and I were the two that kind of get things started. And I talked to her about that brush, and I think I took some photos, and they went to a supplier in boy, and I don't know where, but they went to a supplier, one of our normal suppliers, or I believe out of China. They make some of our other brushes. There are less expensive brushes, and they took that sample or the photo and said, "Could you produce a brush?" And here's what I described. I wanted a brush that had the look of the Asian brush with the metal ferrule, the bamboo looking handle, but I wanted that springy Western performing tip. And I wanted it to be less expensive. I want it to be beginner friendly as far as price wise goes, but professional quality with experience. So I thought that was a tall order for something cheap or inexpensive, but they did it. They did it.
Did they
I was.
do it on the first shot? Was it like you described what you wanted, they made prototypes and the prototypes fit what you wanted? Or did it go through a process where it needed to be refined?
I think it needed to be refined only once, and it was good after that. So the brush manufacturer that we have is very good. They know how to reproduce something according to your needs and wants. And I was shocked when I got the first samples. I think we changed the barrel. It was just maybe changing the barrel or the just maybe the color. It was that simple. But
Gotcha,
the
but the performance
it was amazing.
of the, I don't know what you call the tip of the brush. Is it called like the bristles? I don't know what it's called.
I think bristles, yeah, the bristles,
Okay.
they were phenomenal. And I said, "Well, how much are these going to retail for?" And I was blown away. I was like, "What? You're
Let's talk
kidding."
about it. So you can get an entire set of watercolor brushes. There's five sizes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One is the smallest, five is the largest. They retail, I think, is this correct, for about $25 for all five of them.
Or less. I think the most expensive brush, the number five, which is really equivalent to a number 12 in your
Yes.
other color, in your other watercolor brushes, $5 over, just under $6. I
Yeah,
mean,
$5.50 or $5.25 for the
yeah.
largest brush. So this is the thing, just to put this into perspective, to buy a size 12 of a high quality watercolor brush would start at 40 something dollars, maybe
Well, for
it's a, maybe 30 something dollars, and
well,
then
like
go
for a
to
silver, let's say a black velvet or some of the nylon brushes, you can get them for maybe 15, 20 for that size.
I don't
But
think so.
maybe I haven't bought art supplies in so long.
I don't think you can get a size 12 for 15. I could be wrong. Whatever it is, the Yasutomo Fusion brushes are a fraction of the cost of really good watercolor brushes, like my other favorite brand. They are a fraction of the cost, and the whole thing is kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah. And you know what we could have done? And this was something that I think I had a little influence in. If, let's say, you get this retail and most of the manufacturer would say, "Oh my God," or the cost. Let's say you get the cost and then you multiply it by whatever number to determine a retail. And some manufacturers would take that and say, "Let's just pad that. Let's pad that because the consumer is going to buy that brush for $12 or $13 or whatever." But we didn't do that. We thought, let's give them a screaming deal, something that they're
Let's
going
give the
to be mind.
value to the customer.
Yeah, exactly. Let's blow their minds with the price and the performance. I mean, and that's kind of what Yasutomo did, what they're based on: affordable quality. Quality being the most important. If it isn't quality, we're not bringing it in. It's just not going to happen. has to be good, by the
How are
way.
the brushes selling? I know that amongst my community, they're selling really well because obviously I'm communicating with the people who are in my courses and especially my watercolor course. It's people are going wild over the brushes.
That's funny.
Side of this, are people getting wind of how great these brushes are?
Yes, they're selling really well. Now we're going to bring it. I'll tell you this. I have to say this. It's so cute. I read somewhere on Instagram, someone said the Wendy series brushes. I thought that was really cute. So yes,
Main series people.
your enthusiasm about the fusion brushes has really helped. It's really helped a lot. But I'm seeing that now that they're in the stores, the reputation of them has spread that they are very good. And the quality is excellent. You're not buying something that looks like a brush. You're buying a brush that actually performs and you get a very good price. We are also bringing out flat ones. The flats are coming out. We'll have a half inch. Wait, I think it's a half and a. Oh, I forgot now. It's two sizes basically of flats. And so I'm really excited that those are coming out because I'd like to do some washes with a flat. And so fusion flats are coming soon.
Okay, I have the next product idea. Are you ready?
Yes.
Can this technology be applied to an acrylic brush for use in the mixed media world? Because we still don't have the brushes that everybody loves necessarily, that are economical, that you can use with acrylic paint. That are really great brushes. I mean, I do know some really good brushes, but I don't feel like there's one iconic mixed media set of brushes.
This is Wendy, you're amazing. This, I think, would be a great. I think the hairs as they exist, the fibers that are used would be perfect for a mixed media brush. I think if we shorten the handle just a hair, we could bring the flats and maybe some filberts, maybe an angle, something like that, using those same hairs. I think they make amazing mixed media brushes because I use the flat ones. My samples, I've been using them to do gel medium, to do,
Yes.
yeah, and it's fabulous. And glue, it's stiff enough. If we shorten the hairs just a little bit, I think we could do a mixed media series, Wendy.
Okay, so that's going to be where we go with this is a series of flats in many different sizes that have right short more about how these brushes are designed. But right, the bristles need to be shorter. There does need to be a lot of bristle per brush. For working with acrylic, right? There's acrylic brushes have a lot of density to the bristles.
Yeah. They'd be a little bit shorter and a little stiffer. Maybe the fibers would be just, or the not the fibers, they are nylon, but they certainly will. I'm thinking this would be, why
Hey,
not?
Phoebe. I hope Phoebe's listening.
She will. I'll definitely, she will. So this is how these work. This is how things are born. We get an idea. This one came from, there is a place for this. I don't know how many. There's either acrylic brushes or there are watercolor brushes, and they're really not anything. No one's really developed that I know of mixed media brushes. And why not? I think shortening the handle, like the length of the handle being a watercolor brush, not a long handle like an acrylic brush, but with the performance of the long handled brushes, if that makes sense. And
At the
flats
economical price. So that's
at
a
that, yeah.
key component of it. It's just a lot
Yep.
of brushes are very expensive and you're sort of scared to use them and you're scared to ruin them. And watercolor is one thing because you typically don't ruin watercolor brushes if you use them the right way.
Yeah.
But with the acrylic mediums, you'd probably be going through them faster than you would ever go through watercolor brushes. And it would be nice to have a really high quality brush that was at an affordable price so that you didn't have to have all this fear surrounding your brushes.
What a wonderful thing to at least bring up that these are fabulous mixed media brushes because my samples are working great and I'm kind of beating them up a little bit with the gel mediums and the glues and they're doing great. They're holding up really well. So
How many different size flats are you guys shipping in?
we're doing two right now.
Okay, I could see for a mixed media line being also maybe the five sizes kind of thing,
Yeah,
you know,
like a
with
little
one kind
starting
of
at a
piece.
quarter inch maybe and going up to an inch and a half or something.
Yeah,
Wouldn't that be
definitely one of the
awesome?
bigger ones. It'd be
Hey, look
awesome.
at us. We are developing products right now.
Right now. Okay. All right. Back to your story, because I feel like there's so much more in there. How did you end up on the Carol Duvall show? And first of all, not everyone knows who she is. Maybe a lot of us know who she is, but I was like maybe just a little bit young for the Carol Duvall show.
Well, Carol Duvall, I had heard about her. I was teaching some classes in LA at a rubber stamp store. And I remember doing this, and someone said something, "Oh, you ought to be on the Carol Duvall show." And I thought, who's Carol? At that time, because I wasn't really a TV person, I said, who's that? And then I remember watching the show sometime in the morning, and I thought, oh, she's pretty cool. And I remember seeing her on TV. I was actually involved in the HIA show we had coming up in Anaheim. And so I had just freshly seen Carol, her show, and I'm standing in the booth with all of my little samples of handmade books and paper crafts that were in the Yasutomo booth. And I see down the row a little bit, I see Carol DePaul and her entourage. And I thought, oh my God, there's Carol DePaul. I wouldn't have noticed if I hadn't seen her show. So I kind of stood and watched as she stopped with her team. And she went, oh my God, she just loved, look at these. And she picked up this little book, and it was the Blizzard book. And if you know the Blizzard book, right? The little Blizzard book was a little necklace, little small little thing. And she was just drooling. She was just loving that. And she said, who made this? And I came up and I said, I made this. And she goes, I want this on my show. That's basically what started it. And I scheduled the show, we did it. And then it just built into more shows. And actually, I think I did about 35 shows with her, all paper crafting, origami, kind of.
35 episodes,
Yeah.
you and her.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, this is no small thing.
Well, and I lived in Santa Barbara, so it was easy for me to drive to Burbank and do these. So I'm the local gal now, one of the local artists that they can call on. So in the beginning, I had to pass the test if I could do it. I mean, not every person that would do an episode would be asked back because there were certain criteria you'd have to meet. You'd have to just be able to go with the pro tele television production and step outs and all that. It was pretty intense. And there's actually a really funny story about that because maybe it was my third episode with her. And one thing the production people said, no matter what, if we're rolling the camera, do not stop. If something goes weird, don't stop until we tell you to. And I remember that instruction, but I got in trouble because I did stop because I found myself stumbling over my words and I said, oh, let's stop. And they got really mad at me and I thought, oh, I'm fired. I'll never come back. But I got through that. And then several episodes later, Carol, in the middle of as I'm demonstrating or I'm talking through the steps, she starts coughing and she starts coughing uncontrollably. But I was a good girl. I did not stop and I kept going and she's turning red and finally, they stopped it. But she was so proud of me because I didn't stop. I said, you were going to just drop. You were going to drop because I wasn't going to stop. So, it was just
You
a
know
funny.
why with television cameras, it's not because I feel like with a film camera, they would just say cut and they would stop rolling film. Why with a television camera would you not be able to stop and start again?
Well, because they in the control room, which was separate from the stage, they were watching the feeds. However, I mean, several people in that room, and these were not live shows. They were pre-recorded, so you could
Yeah.
stop and edit and all that. But they had the expertise, and they knew, okay, now if things are really fumbling badly, then they'll stop it. They'll say, okay, cut, Karen, start over. You're not making any sense, or whatever it was. But they didn't think that I was having trouble. I think in my own head, I was having more trouble than I
Okay.
thought. Okay, so I felt, oh, I'm totally having a brain moment. I can't continue. And then I stopped. They didn't see that. They thought I was doing fine. And then I was reprimanded. I was slapped on the hand, not literally, but I was told, don't ever do that again. And I remember taking that very seriously. So that's why she's coughing and ready to drop. And I just kept going. And I remember thinking, nope, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop. But it made it really funny. Carol and I had a bond. We laughed a lot. We ended up becoming really close friends. And we visited her in her Michigan home. And that was an incredible experience. And it kind of launched me as a personality, I guess, which I was a little hesitant to do working for a Japanese company. Like people were recognizing me instead of the brand. And sometimes it would be a little bit delicate for me as a person because I wasn't very comfortable behind that celebrity feeling. People wanted to take pictures and, well, and all that. And it was an interesting time. But I was contacted by publishers to do books and things like that. And that kind of opened me up
So was
in that
this
way.
in the 1980s that this all took place?
In the 90s,
It was in the
definitely.
90s.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And I ended up after the Carol Duvall show stopped producing, then I did a book on origami card craft with a publisher. And I just was doing creative things, still working for Yasutomo. So I had to balance my own personal development with working full time as an employee for a company. So there was a very delicate balance that I had to keep. And I didn't want them to feel that I was not devoted to that first. Because first, it was my allegiance to Yasutomo. And the other part was just happening as a result of being exposed on TV, becoming quote unquote celebrity at that time.
Was the Carol Duvall show on a major network like NBC, ABC, or CBS?
It was on Home and Garden TV, HGTV.
It was on HGTV. I cannot believe I was so clueless. I want to tell you something. At this point in my life, I'm living in Los Angeles in the 90s. I'm going to UCLA School of Law, and I am obsessed at this time in my life with Martha Stewart.
Yes.
And I'm watching the Food Network and HGTV, like every minute I possibly can, which probably isn't that many minutes because I'm in law school, but I'm also making pottery. But I'm like clueless that there's this phenomenon because it sounds like the kind of thing where I would have become obsessed with it had I known that it was on television because I was super crafty.
And it probably came on in the time you were in class because her show aired, I believe, at 9 in the morning every
Yeah, okay, that would
Friday.
explain it.
Yeah. So that one, because of that time slot, that's probably why I think you would have loved her. I think you would have loved her show because she was so engaging. She was so supportive of the artist and she was so passionate. I mean, she was a crafter herself and she was so passionate about it. And she just knew how to guide the whole steps and make it a smooth. I mean, she was a pro. I mean, this woman was a pro and very unique. She was unique and one of a kind.
So, was it up to you to come up with the 35 projects that you taught?
So how it worked, so the first project was one she saw at the trade show. So that was the first one. And then I would start, I don't remember how, but I would submit projects or ideas. I might send, I don't remember, it was way before our smartphones. So I'm trying to remember how I did that. But I would usually like submit something to her and or her production company.
And
Because
at
that
this time, you're still working full time at Yasutomo?
And usually, and yes, and I always made sure that it was aligned with Yasutomo. So I wasn't going there as Karen, the artist. I was going there on the show to help promote Yasutomo products. So I
Oh my
was.
gosh. Did the Carol Duvall show pay you?
No,
Oh
no.
my gosh. You
No,
ended up
so.
becoming like a celebrity and you're providing all this. And you don't get compensation for this. You're just working for Yasutomo.
I'm working as an employee for Yasutomo, yes, and I'm getting this incredible experience for free for me. I mean, it was like totally an unintended ex kind of benefit was becoming known as a personality rather than just my affiliation with Yasutomo. And that's what, again, I mentioned that the balance was a little tricky at that time. The company I worked for wasn't really understanding how beneficial that could be. Like Tim Holtz was catapulted through that, and then all the brands that he's helped that at
Wait,
that.
was he catapulted through the same show?
Yes, I mean, I think that is definitely where he became well known. And at that time, Ranger really kind of supported that and they understood it. And it and Sotomo at the time didn't, but it's okay. It worked out really well in every for everybody because if I had gone the route that, say, Tim Holtz had gone, it would have been a different story. I would have had to have left Yasutomo and been independent at that time. And I wasn't wanting to do that. I enjoyed working as part of a team for a company. I enjoyed working for my boss. Now, I don't know if I've told you, but during the end of the Carol Duvall show, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was stage two at the time. And when I said, I'm going to have to go on disability for a period of time with, through treatment, and I didn't think I would be able to work. And he said, I want you to not worry about that. He continued to pay me through the whole period with, and I wasn't doing anything except trying to get through the treatment and the surgeries. And that's why I believe that my relationship with the Yasutomo was more important than me developing as an artist. It was just so important to me to be part of that team. And he
That
talked,
makes total sense to me that it's like everything really did happen for a reason the way it happened. There's no oh, regrets. It should have happened a different way because everything ended up happening like the way that it needed to happen.
No regrets at all. Total respect and actually admiration. I actually have two people that I put in this on pedestals, and one is Carol Duvall, and the other one is my former boss, Dan Igusa. I put they're on a pedestal. I can't help it. They're the people who have, I believe, have influenced me as personally and professionally and in ways that I can't describe. It's just, I just feel this incredible honor that I've been able to work with them and get to know them and really have a friendship and a relationship that is just so rich. And I don't regret anything on how it went down. And now that I can be an artist that can promote myself, because I am an independent contractor, I have my own business now and I work with Yasutomo, but they embrace my artistic journey and they congratulate me on seeing the strides that are happening, and they're very supportive, and it's just a, it's so fantastic. I'm just keep kind of pinching myself. Is this still happening?
It's amazing how long and successful your career has been. So I remember like us learning about each other because you must have joined fodder school. Is that how it happened?
Well, I approached you. If you remember, I kind of sent you a, I think I sent you a message through Instagram saying maybe this would be a great project for fodder school someday. And you contacted me right away. We need to talk because, you know, I had, we had to have a conversation. And then and then it happened. It happened.
Wait, so
And
you're saying we started talking to each other, but you were not a participant in fodder school.
no, I had not. I was
You
attracted.
contacted us.
I know. Yes.
Okay, I have no recollection of this
Yeah,
other
no, I had seen your, I noticed your work, not necessarily, I hadn't really seen Fodder School yet. I was just, every time I'd see your posts, I was just totally attracted. I thought, oh, this girl, I love this stuff, what she's doing. And I was especially attracted to your wonky bits.
Yeah.
And I did purchase that class. I just thought I needed to know what you used to make those lines. I was like, whoa. And I know that it would have been rude. Even though I know people ask all the time, what pen do you use or what's this? And I wanted to do it. So I took your class and it was a short and sweet, wonderful thing. And I could have figured that out, but I'm so glad I did it. And I loved your style of teaching and guiding. It was like you doing, you just, I felt kind of a similarity in our, in a kind of way
An
of thinking and
affinity.
sharing.
Okay, so this is making more sense. So you were not a participant in Fodder School One.
No.
Okay, now it makes sense. So you took Wonky Bits, and that's when I saw your Instagram account.
Yes, and then I do believe now Fodder School One, you have to rewind here. I did, I think I ended up purchasing the class, or the course, the whole
Yeah.
year afterwards. Definitely, I think I definitely I thought, well, this is an investment. If I'm going to be, you know, hopefully part of Fodder School Two, I need to participate in Fodder School One. So I did end up buying the class after it had already started, and I was, I loved it. I loved Tiffany's watercolor flowers. I was, that's one. I think that's Fodder School One.
That is Fodder School One. Okay, so this is making sense. So at the point where you take Wonky Bits and you start posting on Instagram and tagging me, that's when
That's it.
I look at your Instagram account and I'm like, wow, this woman is talented. And then I start following you. And I mean, the level of your knowledge and talent, I don't even think that I comprehended it probably until 6 months ago.
Wow. And it's mutual admiration society, because I thought the same of you. I was just blown away by your work. I went to your website and I saw your journals and I thought, these are fantastic. And your affinity for watercolor. I loved your color palette, and it was different than mine. I was really inspired by your work. And then being part of photo school, I thought, this is fantastic. You've got all these instructors. You bring in a total variety of instructors for people with different mindsets, different ways that they want to create. It's like a big smorgasbord of creativity.
It is a
And
smorgasbord. So what I'm finding that I'm really discovering, you're like an onion. You have so many layers or so many whatever you call it. There's so many layers of the skin and the onion and all this stuff. And every time I have a long conversation with you, there's new layers that are revealed. And it's amazing to me. I feel very obtuse in a way, because how long is it really taking me to discover the full breadth and depth of what Karen Elaine provides? You're such a valuable member of our teaching crew, of our community. Like, you're incredible.
Well, I'm feeling this. I'm feeling very grateful and honored to be part of it. I mean, to me, I'm still pinching myself. Like I say, I think that it's just being a part of this community is so wonderful. And especially the pandemic started and the world has changed. It has changed. And being part of this online virtual community where you can connect through creativity and art and kind of express what is happening and just getting to know people on a different level through creativity. It's just, you've really created an amazing community, by the way.
Okay, so all the puzzle pieces are starting to come together. So you had a 30-year career, but you were not on Instagram until a couple years ago.
Well, I've been on Instagram, but I wasn't really doing much.
Okay, you weren't active on Instagram. And then
No,
at
I,
some point, you decided, hey, this is worth me investing my time in. Was that the point where you had gone from working as an employee at Yasutomo to being a consultant? Is that when you made the transition to, I'm going to be also a content creator in my own right?
Exactly. I actually, as an employee, I didn't feel that if I used my time not doing things for Yasutomo, of course I would not do it. So as soon as I became an independent and I had an arrangement with the new Yasutomo, I felt I can explore this. I can do things on social media and toot my own horn if I want. Kind of felt, well, it was time. I felt I have the freedom to do it because I'm in my own business. And so I did. I just started sharing my work and not being shy about it. I just started kind of regularly posting. I had no goal except just to share my work. I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to do this in a certain amount of years and I'm going to sell that. I didn't have that in mind. I just wanted to share.
I totally understand that. That's how my whole Instagram thing started. There was no end goal. It was just, I'm just going to be here. I'm going to share. And then things just happen.
And I'm blown away when I just hit 100K followers last couple of days ago. I'm going, what?
Oh, you're
What
going to buy me. You're going to have 200K by the end
do
of like this
I
year.
do now? Nothing. I'm going to do the same thing. I
It
just want to.
doesn't make any difference, honestly. Unfortunately, having a lot of followers on Instagram is kind of it's kind of unfortunately like very misunderstood. Like people have some kind of thought that it means something or that it gets you something, but really only your hard work gets you things. And numbers of Instagram followers, it's very difficult to understand why one person has 20,000 followers and another has 100,000 and another person has 1,000. Because it has nothing to do with how good of an artist someone is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think from what I'm understanding, because now that I've done it and it's happening and I'm kind of blown away, but it really is about just posting regularly. I mean, there is the just posting your work. And if you find a niche or if you find something that people are attracted to, I found that when I joined fodder school and I started sharing my fodder school experiences, I saw an increase. I saw growth there. And then now that I'm sharing my watercolors, and which I'm excited about what we're going to be doing, is that is really blown it up because just, I mean, just enjoying, I'm just sharing what I have, what gives me joy. And I guess it's hopefully giving other people joy. And the quotes that are going along with that in a difficult time in our world, I think that's giving people a little happiness at the same time. So
Oh,
that's
that
kind
makes a lot of sense. It's like the combination
of,
of the positive affirmations or just even the deep thoughts along with your art that is watercolor is like a magical combination of what people are very like responding to very well right now. They need it right now. So
Yeah.
let's talk about where you're going with this. Let's talk about the course that you've been developing and what you're going to include in the course.
Yeah, so deep dive. This course was actually developed. I started to develop this course in person a few years ago, and it was called Deep Dive into Watercolor back then. And it was just a way to get, it's not like a traditional watercolor course where you would end up with a painting at the end or something like that. It is just a kind of an exploration of watercolor as a medium. And experiencing and developing skills to take wherever you want your watercolor journey to take you. But with my long-term experience with colors, pigments, color mixing, I integrate a little bit of that into the course. We came up with a really good title for it, Watercolor for Joy, which I think that's exactly why I do watercolor, because it gives so much joy. But the course is full of little snippets of bits and pieces that can fall together with practices, color mixing, swatching, birds, leaves. You've seen my samples up on Instagram if you are a follower. And you'll end up with, at the end of it, all these little chaotic bits and pieces will end up with two wonderful journals that you'll have finished by the end. And it's
So
very
it's a
unusual.
very technique heavy course in but delivered in a way that's super fun. So it's not boring technique. You have all these different exercises that, like I said, are very fun. And as a result of doing those exercises, you deepen your knowledge of watercolor technique so that you've got all this experience and then you've got these incredibly adorable two books that you come out with in the end. But even more so than that, you fully deepen your own knowledge and you apply that to all of your watercolor painting from there forward because your knowledge will have been so deepened.
And depending on where you want to take that journey, some people want to paint pictures of their landscapes or experiences. They want to go out and paint a building or a portrait. The watercolor skills that you'll get from this course will help you go forward, like you said. And you will have only good experiences with colors rather than those negative ones that sometimes can intimidate or stop people in their tracks when it comes to watercolor. Because I've heard so many people say, oh, watercolor is so intimidating. I'm afraid of it. It's the most fantastic medium. And we just have to know the differences with pigments and water, how water is the first ingredient in watercolor. I've seen many people become discouraged because they just load their brush up with the pigment and it just kind of dry, it goes dry on the paper, and they don't really take advantage of the water, the flow, and how the colors can dance together and have their own little thing. And I'm hoping that this course has translated all that into something that people can take away and have just be totally inspired to do whatever they want to do. And if they wanted to make birds and leaves, that's great too.
One of the things that I really appreciate about the course is that it was a very long time in development. So it's not something that you just said 2 months ago. I feel like developing a course because my Instagram following is 100,000 and I need to get a course out there. This is a course that you have actually brainstormed for years. And not only that, you've run the course before, so you could talk about that. You ran the course as a live-ish kind of experience and worked out some of the kinks.
Yes, so I with Sedona Art Center, because that's the place I do teach, I was teaching it in person. We decided to do an online course, and it was deep dive into watercolor. And I did develop the course that people will see with Willa Wanders. I actually did a test run not only with the Sedona Art Center, but maybe 2 months before that, I have a group of women there. There's about 10 or so women that I ran the test with them first, and then I ran it with a open live course, which I had about 30 students, and then this one. So I've had some practice, and I found that each time I was able to eliminate some steps or to add things. I was so glad that I did that way because I think just coming up with something, I don't know. I think having the experience of what works and what didn't work, and in the comments from my students, they gave me the feedback that I needed to kind of keep developing it into what it is now.
This makes total sense to me because I recently both taught live and also did a very weird kind of semi in real time development of an online course where I would release a week of content and then I would get feedback and questions and then I would create the next content. So I didn't create all the content in advance and release the whole thing all at once. It was an ongoing experience for both the participants and me.
Yes, sounds
And
really.
I learned so much about the problems that people have that prevent them from really feeling super comfortable with watercolor.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned, one of my number one takeaways from teaching live is seeing how people don't use enough water
Right.
and being able to communicate to people about how to use watercolor in a way that's far less frustrating for them. I've just learned a lot. You've learned a lot. And I know that your course is going to be everything that we want it to be because you've put in all that real work with people to understand how to communicate in the best way possible to make watercolor really a very easy medium because watercolor is not a difficult medium.
Right.
Like, I don't know what people think is difficult, but people all over the world are intimidated by this medium that I think is the easiest of all the mediums. I don't
Yeah.
know. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I feel the same. When I first started working in watercolor, and this was in Santa Barbara, I had a really great teacher. He did the traditional thing where you'd sketch out a drawing on a large full sheet of expensive 300-pound watercolor paper. And he would not talk about color mixing so much, but it was about light and dark and shadows, the kind of the traditional drawing methodology. But I didn't understand at that time about pigments. And I was putting layers and layers of opaque pigments pretty much, and I just killed the drawing and painting. It just didn't look right. It just kind of died. So that luminosity and that beautiful vibrance, it was gone. And I learned quickly that, oh, I need to know about these watercolor pigments a little bit more. Now, that was before I worked at the art supply store. So this is what I got out of my beta testers. Most of the early group, they were not experienced watercolorists, but in my second group at the Sedona Art Center, the live group, I had a very experienced watercolor artist who took away from the course. She was kind of mind blown. She said, "Your color mixing, it's a game changer. You can introduce your basic color palette, which is my go-to, and then you can start bringing in other pigments as you go along. But it makes it so that the beginner can buy the best watercolors without breaking the bank, because you're only buying just three or four colors."
Well, we have the same philosophy on this because I'm
Yeah.
a very limited palette person, and three or four colors is all anyone needs. Anything else that I use is just extra bonus
It's fluff.
for
It's one.
fun. It's
It's
fluff. It's unnecessary. You can
and
absolutely mix everything with three to four colors.
yeah.
I'm so excited to apply my own knowledge and my own experience to doing your lessons because I think it's going to be a whole different experience, right? Because I am an experienced watercolor painter, but I know that I'm going to learn so much doing your course and I'm going to have honestly so much joy. That's to me, that's the number one thing. It's am I doing things where I feel joyful, where I get into flow state, where at the end I feel good about what I created. And I just can't wait. I cannot wait until we release this course.
I can't wait either. I am so excited because there are people just, they just like, "I want to take your course. I want to take your course." And I think the perfect platform is yours because your approach to creativity is just aligned with mine. And I'm so happy that this is happening.
All right, it's happening and it's happening soon. And I hope that everyone who listens to this podcast goes and looks at Karen's work on Instagram. So I know that you in the last year changed your Instagram name. So tell us what your Instagram name is.
It's Karen Elaine, all one word, creative, all one word. So my first and middle name and creative. So one word, Karen Elaine Creative.
Okay, so if you do not already know Karen Aline Creative, which I'm guessing a lot of people do, but if you don't already know Karen, go follow her on Instagram, be her 100,000th follower, her 105,000th or her 120,000th. Go check out what Karen is about and join us in taking watercolor for joy because it's gonna be joyful.
I'm excited, and I'm going to take your course, Wendy, because I want to do watercolor for relaxation.
It's funny, as different as our art looks, it is from the same foundational place.
I love it. Any excuse, if I want to get my watercolors out, that's where I'm in my happy place.
That's exactly right. Any excuse to paint with watercolors, and I am in my happy place. So
Yes.
if watercolors are your happy place, or you think they might be your happy place because you want to give it a try, I'd say take both of our courses. Don't just take mine. If you've already taken mine, the perfect next step is to take Karen's. Just because you've taken mine and you feel like you learned a ton, there is more to learn, even though you might feel really competent. Karen is teaching totally other things. Okay, so that's an interesting thing. People are going to, I know they're going to email me and they're going to say, what's the difference?
Yeah.
What's the difference in the classes? They're so different. They are so different. But you learn a lot in both. And look, there's more to learn. So even if you've taken my class, there's still a lot more to learn.
And I'm always learning. I mean, that's just a lifelong learner. I think that we get so much from from your course. I'm sure that if I were to take it, and I'm going to, by the way, yeah, I'm going to get an experience that I will learn something new. Absolutely. And I think just by practicing and doing something over and over, you're going to get that muscle memory. You're going to get the confidence to paint and make the most happy, joyful watercolors, or you can go into landscapes, whatever it is. It's just going to give you, I think, just doing things over and in different angles, different approaches, you're going to just build that skill set that's going to make you feel confident going forward in your art.
Your course has a lot more whimsy than mine. That I will say. Like, your whole style lends itself to joy and whimsy and fun in a way that my personal style does not.
I don't take myself seriously in a sense. I know, and I think we all are in that place. We have to have a sense of humor. And so if we do make a mistake, we make a muddy thing. I mean, it's just a piece of paper and it's just watercolor. So if we kind of take our egos out of it a little bit, because I know we want to make something pretty and we want to, do a good job at something, but really just do it for the experience and the joy of it. And not everything is going to be perfect or pleasant to look at even sometimes, but it's going to be the experience, and that's where we get that fulfillment. Absolutely. And then you'll see progress as you keep going.
Oh, I guarantee you'll see a ton of progress
And
if
look,
you.
but the lettering course I took from with you, Wendy, oh my gosh, my lettering has, people are just commenting all the time, oh, I love your handwriting. Well, how did that happen? Well, there was a wonderful course that was offered that it actually, the way that it was approached, it worked for me. I've taken calligraphy courses, but what it, the way that the handwriting, you can mention the name of it, it
Love your
really,
imperfect letters.
it worked for me. It was like the big light bulb that needed to go off in my head to develop a lettering style that works for me. And everybody's going to be different. It's not a duplication. I'm not going to go, oh, I'm going to be doing Wendy's style or so-and-so style. This was developed so that you can develop your own style. And that was brilliant.
Thank you. It was a little strike of magic. It
It
was
was.
years and years also in the making of just being someone who's been a hand letterer my whole entire life. And then having all of these things come together where I was like, oh, people can do their own style. It doesn't have to be about copying someone else's style. How does one develop their own style? While using a lot of the learning techniques that are foundational to calligraphy.
I
But
think that's
applying it to
key.
something that you can take with you without all the stress of being perfect.
It was beautiful, just brilliant in all ways. And it was like the best, whatever, a few bucks I've ever spent. I mean, no, it's just, Fantastic. And that's what we'll be with these. What if you take watercolor or any art course from anyone in any platform, you're going to get something out of it just by working and kind of going through the eyes of the artist who's teaching it. But then you're going to still move along, and you're going to maybe you want to duplicate it because you love that so much. And that's okay too, because I don't share things and expect people to not duplicate if that's what they're inspired to do. That is, I'm sharing it because I want you to. And but then you're going to still find your own signature, your own brush stroke, your own everything. It's going to be yours.
Yeah, I think people who take this are going to become highly competent at watercolor painting.
And I hope the most thing is they're going to have fun. They're going to
Yeah.
enjoy and have and laugh. And I think when I was filming the course, there were times I was kind of cracking up. It's some of the with the shapes, making the shapes and just kind of loosening up. And that's what I'm hoping that everybody will get from this, is just kind of getting freeing yourself to just explore the color and make shapes and kind of find your way. And it's just, I think it's going to be fun.
All right. I want to thank you so much for spending almost 2 hours.
Oh my God, time flies when you're having fun.
I hope that we got the bulk of your story. Or, I mean, there's things obviously that we didn't even talk about, your cancer survivor story. I'm sure in the future, I hope to have you back on because we are kind of like a match made in heaven here.
There are more layers to the onion. I
There
know
are more layers to the onion, and we hope to obviously have you back as a fodder school teacher again.
Oh, yes, I hope so.
Yeah, Karen is very involved in fodder school. Even though she's not a fodder school 3 teacher, she was a fodder school 2 teacher. And definitely, I mean, if you have time for it in your schedule, we would love to have you come back. So
Ah, I'd be.
good luck with your construction that I know is about to happen in
Thank
30
you.
minutes, any moment. I'll let you go for now. Thank you again. And oh, just what's your website in case people want to check out your website?
It's KarenElaine.com.
Beautiful. All right. Have
Easy
a
peasy.
great rest of your day, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Wendy.
You're so welcome.
Talk
Talk to you
again
later.
soon. Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Show Up or Shut Up podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast and leave a rating and review. And once again, you can find me, Wendy, free gifts for newsletter subscribers, online classes with me and many other incredible instructors, my blog, and everything else at willowwanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders. Talk to you soon. Until then, stay curious and keep making.